property owned by someone way older and more important than myself. Alex walks more surely now, occasionally sweeping a branch out of the way so I can pass underneath it, or swatting at the branches blocking our way. But we're not following any path that I can see. And after 15 minutes, I begin to fear that we're just turning in circles or going deeper and deeper into the woods without any real destination. I'm about to ask him how he knows where we're going when I notice that every so often he hesitates and sweeps his flashlight over the tree trunks that surround us like tall, ghostly silhouettes. Some of them I see are marked with a swath of blue paint. "The paint," I say. Alex shoots me a look over his shoulder. "Our roadmap," he says, pressing on, and then adds, "You don't want to get lost in here, trust me." And then, abruptly, the trees just peter out. One second we're in the middle of the forest, penned in on all sides, and the next we're stepping out onto a paved road, a ribbon of concrete lit silver by the moonlight like a ribbed tongue. The road is filled with holes and cracked and buckled in places, so we have to step around enormous piles of concrete rubble. It winds up a long, low hill and then disappears over the hill's crest, where another black fringe of trees begins. "Give me your hand," Alex says. He's whispering again, and without knowing why, I'm glad of it. For some reason, I feel as though I've just entered a cemetery. On either side of the road are gigantic clearings, covered in waist-high grasses that sing and whisper against one another, and some thin young trees which look frail and exposed in the middle of all of that openness. There seem to be some beams, too, enormous beams of timber piled on top of one another, and twists of things that look metallic, gleaming and glinting in the grass. "What is this?" I whisper to Alex, but just after I ask the question, a little scream builds in my throat, and I see, and I know. In the middle of one of the fields of whispering grass is a large blue truck, perfectly intact, like someone might have driven up just to have a picnic. "This was a street," Alex says. His voice has turned tense. "Destroyed during the Blitz. There are thousands and thousands of them all across the country, bombed out, totally destroyed." I shiver. No wonder I felt like I was walking through a graveyard. I am, in a way. The Blitz was a year-long campaign that happened long before my birth, when my mom was still a baby. It was supposed to have gotten rid of all the invalids and any resistors who didn't want to leave their homes and move into an approved community. My mother once said that her earliest memories were all clouded by the sound of bombs and the smell of smoke. She said for years the smell of fire continued to drift over the city, and every time the wind blew, it would bring with it a covering of ash. We go on walking. I feel like I could cry. Being here, seeing this, it's nothing like what I was taught in my history classes. Smiling pilots giving the thumbs up, people cheering at the borders because we were at last safe, houses incinerated neatly with no mess, as though they were just blipped off a computer screen. In the history books, there were no people, really, who lived in these houses. They were shadows, wraiths, unreal. But as Alex and I walk hand in hand down the bombed-out road, I understand that it wasn't like that at all. There was mess and stink and blood and the smell of skin burning. There were people standing and eating, talking on the phone, frying eggs or singing in the shower. I am overwhelmed with sadness for everything that was lost, and filled with anger toward the people who took it away. My people, or at least my old people. I don't know who I am anymore or where I belong. That's not totally true. Alex. I know I belong with Alex. A little farther up the hill, we come across a trim white house standing in the middle of a field. Somehow it escaped the Blitz unscathed. And other than a shutter that has become detached and is now hanging at a crazy angle, tapping lightly in the wind, it could be any house in Portland. It looks so strange standing there in the middle of all of that emptiness, surrounded by the shrapnel of disintegrated neighbors. It looks tiny all on its own, like a single lamb that has gotten lost in the wrong pasture. "Does anyone stay there now?" I ask Alex. Sometimes people squat when it's rainy or freezing. Only the roamers, though. The invalids who always move around. Again, he pauses for a fraction of a second before he says invalids, grimacing like the word tastes bad in his mouth. We pretty much stay away from here. People say the bombers might come back and finish off the job, but mostly it's just superstition. People think the house is bad luck. He gives me a tight smile. It's been totally cleaned out, though. Beds, blankets, clothes, everything. I got my dishes there. Earlier, Alex told me he had his own special place in the wilds, but when I pressed him for details, he clammed up and told me I'd have to wait and see. It's still weird to think of people living out here in the middle of all this vastness, needing dishes and blankets and normal things like that. This way. Alex pulls me off the road and draws me toward the woods again. I'm actually happy to be back in the trees. There was a heaviness to that strange open space with its single house and rusting truck and splintered buildings, a gash cut in the surface of the world. This time we follow a fairly well-worn path. The trees are still splattered with blue paint at intervals, but it doesn't seem as though Alex needs to consult them. We go quickly, single file. The trees have been shoved away here, and much of the underbrush has been cleared so the walk is much easier. Beneath my feet, the dirt has been tamped down over time by the pressure of dozens of feet. My heart starts thumping heavily against my ribs. I can tell we're getting close. Alex turns around to face me, so abruptly I almost slam into him. He clicks the flashlight off, and in the sudden darkness, strange shapes seem to rise up, take form, swirl away. "Close your eyes," he says, and I can tell he's smiling. Why bother? I can't see anything. I can practically hear him roll his eyes. "Come on, Lena." "Fine." I close my eyes, and he takes my hands in both of his. Then he pulls me forward another 20 feet, murmuring things like, "Step up, there's a rock," or "A little to the left." The whole time, a fluttery, nervous feeling builds inside of me. We stop, finally, and Alex drops my hands. "We're here," he says. I can hear the excitement in his voice. "Open up." I do, and for a moment, can't speak. I open my mouth several times and have to shut it again after all that emerges is a high-pitched squeak. "Well?" Alex fidgets next to me. "What do you think?" Finally, I stutter out. It's real. Alex snorts. "Of course it's real. I mean, it's amazing." I take a few steps forward. Now that I'm here, I'm not sure what exactly I was imagining the wilds would be like, but whatever it wasn't this. A long, broad clearing cuts through the woods, although in places the trees have begun to crowd in again, pushing slender stalks toward the sky, which stretches above us, a vast and glittering canopy, the moon sitting bright and huge and swollen at its center. Wild roses encircle a dented sign, faded nearly to illegibility. I can just make out the words, Crest Village Mobile Park. The clearing is full of dozens of trailers, as well as more creative residences, tarps stretched between trees, with blankets and shower curtains to serve as front doors, rusting trucks with tents pitched in the back of their cabs, old vans with fabric stretched over their windows for privacy. The clearing is pitted with holes where campfires have been lit over the course of the day. Now, well past midnight, they are smoldering still, letting up ribbons of smoke and the smell of charred wood. "See?" Alex grins and spreads his arms. "The blitz didn't get everything."
"You didn't tell me."
I start walking forward down the center of the clearing, stepping around a series of logs that have been arranged in a circle like an outdoor living room. "You didn't tell me it was like this." He shrugs, trotting next to me like a happy dog.
"It's the kind of thing you need to see for yourself."
He toes a bit of dirt over a dying campfire.
"Looks like we came too late for the party tonight."
As we progress through the clearing, Alex points out every house and tells me a little bit about the people who live there, speaking all the time in a whisper so we won't wake anybody. Some stories I've heard before, others are totally new. I'm not even fully concentrating, but I'm grateful for the sound of his voice, low and steady and familiar and reassuring. Even though the settlement isn't that big, maybe an eighth of a mile long, I feel as though the world has suddenly split open, revealing layers and depths I could never have imagined. No walls. No walls anywhere. Portland, by comparison, seems tiny. A blip. Alex stops in front of a dingy gray trailer. Its windows are missing and have been replaced by squares of multicolored fabric pulled taut. And, this is me. Alex gestures awkwardly. It's the first time he has seemed nervous all night, which makes me nervous. I swallow back this sudden and totally inappropriate urge to laugh hysterically. Wow, it's not much from the outside. Alex jumps in. He looks away, chewing on a corner of his lip. Do you want to, come in? I nod, pretty sure that if I tried to speak right now, I would only squeak again. I've been alone with him countless times, but this feels different. Here, there are no eyes waiting to catch us, no voices waiting to shout at us, no hands ready to tear us apart. Just miles and miles of space. It's exciting and terrifying at the same time. Anything could happen here. And when he bends down to kiss me, it's as though the weight of the velvety darkness around us, the soft flutters of the trees, the pitter-patter of the unseen animals come beating into my chest, making me feel as though I'm dissolving and expanding into the night. When he pulls away, it takes me a few seconds to catch my breath. Come on, he says. He leans a shoulder against the door of the trailer until it pops open. Inside, it's very dark. I can make out only a few rough outlines, and when Alex shuts the door behind us, even those vanish, sucked up into black. There's no electricity out here, Alex says. He's moving around, bumping up against things, cursing every so often under his breath. Do you have candles? I ask. The trailer smells strange, like autumn leaves that have fallen off their branches. It's nice. There are other smells, too, the sharp citrus sting of cleaning fluid and very faintly the tang of gasoline. Even better. I hear rustling and a spray of water descends on me from above. I let out a small shriek and Alex says, Sorry, I haven't been here in a while. Watch out. More rustling. And then slowly the ceiling above my head trembles and folds back on itself, and all of a sudden the sky is revealed in its enormity. The moon sits almost directly above us, streaming light into the trailer and crowning everything in silver. I see now that the ceiling is, in fact, one enormous plastic tarp, a bigger version of the kind of thing you'd use to cover a grill. Alex is standing on a chair, rolling it back, and with every inch, more of the sky is revealed, and everything inside only seems to glow brighter. My breath catches in my throat. It's beautiful. Alex shoots me a look over his shoulder and grins. He continues folding back the tarp, pausing every few minutes to stop, scoot his chair forward, and begin again. One day a storm took out half the roof. I wasn't here, fortunately. He too is glowing. His arms and shoulders touched with silver. Just as I did on the night of the raids, I think of the portraits in church of the angels with their sprouting wings. I decided I might as well get rid of the whole thing. He finishes with the tarp and jumps lightly off the chair, turning to face me, smiling. It's my own convertible house. It's incredible, I say. I really mean it. The sky looks so close. I feel like I could reach up and slap my fingers on the moon. Now I'll get the candles. Alex scoots past me toward the kitchen area and starts rummaging. I can see the big stuff now, though details are still lost in the darkness. There's a small wood stove in one corner. At the opposite end is a twin bed. My stomach does a tiny flip when I see it, and 1,000 memories flood me at once. Carol sitting on my bed and telling me in her measured voice about the expectations of husband and wife.
Jenny sticking her hand on her hip and telling me I won't know what to do when the time comes. Whispered stories of Willow Marks. Hannah wondering out loud in the locker room what sex feels like, while I hissed at her to be quiet, checking over my shoulder to make sure no one was listening. Alex finds a bunch of candles and starts lighting them one by one, and corners of the room flare into focus as he sets the candles carefully around the trailer. What strikes me most are the books. Lumpy shapes that in the half-dark appeared to be a part of the furniture now resolve into towering stacks of books, more books than I've seen anywhere, except for at the library. There are three bookshelves mashed against one wall. Even the refrigerator, whose door has come unhinged, is filled with books. I take a candle and scan the titles. I don't recognize any of them. What are these? Some of the books look so old and cracked, I'm afraid if I touch them, they'll crumble to bits. I mouth the names, I read off the spines, at least the ones I can make out. Emily Dickinson, Walt Whitman, William Wordsworth. Alex glances at me.
That's poetry, he says.
What's poetry? I've never heard the word before, but I like the sound of it. It sounds elegant and easy somehow, like a beautiful woman turning in a long dress. Alex lights the last candle. Now the trailer is filled with warm, flickering light. He joins me by the bookshelf and squats, looking for something. He removes a book and stands, passes it to me for inspection. Famous love poetry. My stomach flips as I see that word, love, printed so brazenly on a book cover. Alex is watching me closely, so to cover up my discomfort, I open the book and scan the list of featured authors listed on the first few pages. Shakespeare? This name I do recognize from health class. The guy who wrote Romeo and Juliet, the cautionary tale? Alex snorts. It's not a cautionary tale, he says. It's a great love story. I think about that first day at the labs, the first time I ever saw Alex. It seems like a lifetime ago. I remember my mind churning out the word beautiful. I remember thinking something about sacrifice. They banned poetry years ago, right after they discovered a cure. He takes the book back from me and opens it. Would you like to hear a poem? I nod. He coughs, then clears his throat, then squares his shoulders and rolls his neck like he's about to be let into a soccer game. Go on, I say, laughing. You're stalling. He clears his throat again and begins to read. Shall I compare thee to a summer's day? I close my eyes and listen. The feeling I had before of being surrounded by warmth swells and crests inside of me like a wave. Poetry isn't like any writing I've ever heard before. I don't understand all of it, just bits and images, sentences that appear half-finished, all fluttering together like brightly colored ribbons in the wind. It reminds me, I realize, of the music that struck me dumb nearly 2 months ago at the farmhouse. It has the same effect and makes me feel exhilarated and sad at the same time. Alex finishes reading. When I open my eyes, he's staring at me. What? I ask. The intensity of his gaze nearly knocks the breath out of me, as though he's staring straight into me. He doesn't answer me directly. He flips forward a few pages in the book, but he doesn't glance down at it. He keeps his eyes on me the whole time. You want to hear a different one? He doesn't wait for me to answer before beginning to recite. How do I love thee? Let me count the ways. There's that word again. Love. My heart stops when he says it, then stutters into a frantic rhythm. I love thee to the depth and breadth and height my soul can reach. I know he's only speaking someone else's words, but they seem to come from him anyway. His eyes are dancing with light. In each of them I see a bright point of candlelight reflected. He takes a step forward and kisses my forehead softly. I love thee to the level of every day's most quiet need.
It feels as though the floor is swinging like I'm falling. Alex, I start to say, but the word gets tangled in my throat. He kisses each cheekbone, a delicious skimming kiss, barely grazing my skin. I love thee freely. Alex, I say a little louder. My heart is beating so fast I'm afraid it will burst from my ribs. He pulls back and gives me a small, crooked smile.
Elizabeth Barrett Browning, he says,
then traces a finger over the bridge of my nose.
You don't like it?
The way he says it, so low and serious, still staring into my eyes, makes me feel as though he's actually asking something else. No, I mean, yes, I mean, I do, but... The truth is, I'm not sure what I mean. I can't think or speak clearly. A single word is swirling around inside me, a storm, a hurricane, and I have to squeeze my lips together to keep it from swelling up to my tongue and fighting its way out into the open. Love, 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 love. A word I've never pronounced, not to anyone, a word I've never even really let myself think.
You don't have to explain.
Alex takes another step backward. Again, I have the sense, confusedly, that we're actually talking about something else. I've disappointed him somehow. Whatever has just passed between us, and something did, even if I'm not sure what or how or why, has made him sad. I can see it in his eyes, even though he's still smiling, and it makes me want to apologize or throw my arms around him and ask him to kiss me, but I'm still afraid to open my mouth, afraid that the word will come shooting out, and terrified about what comes afterward.
Come here.
Alex sets the book down and offers me his hand.
I want to show you something.
He leads me over to the bed, and again, a wave of shyness overtakes me. I'm not sure what he expects, and when he sits down, I hang back, feeling self-conscious.
It's okay, Lena, he says.
As always, hearing him say my name relaxes me. He scoots backward on the bed and lies down on his back, and I do the same, so we're lying side by side. The bed is narrow. There's just enough room for the two of us.
See?
Alex says, tilting his chin upward. Above our heads, the stars flare and glitter and flash. Thousands and thousands of them, so many thousands they look like snowflakes whirling away into the inky dark. I can't help it. I gasp. I don't think I've ever seen so many stars in my life. The sky looks so close, strung so taut above our heads, beyond the roofless trailer. It feels as though we're falling into it, as though we could jump off the bed and the sky would catch us, hold us, bounce us like a trampoline.
What do you think?
Alex asks. I love it. The word pops out, and instantly the weight on my chest dissipates.
I love it,
I say again, testing it. An easy word to say once you say it. Short, to the point, rolls off the tongue. It's amazing I've never said it before. I can tell Alex is pleased. The smile in his voice grows bigger.
The no plumbing thing is kind of a bummer, he says. But you have to admit the view is killer.
I wish we could stay here, I blurt out, and then quickly stutter. I mean, not really, not for good, but you know what I mean. Alex moves his arm under my neck, so I inch over and lay my head in the spot where his shoulder meets his chest, where it fits perfectly.
I'm glad you got to see it, he says.
For a while, we just lie there in silence. His chest rises and falls with his breathing, and after a while, the motion starts to lull me to sleep. My limbs feel impossibly heavy, and the stars seem to be rearranging themselves into words. I want to keep looking, to read out their meaning, but my lids are heavy too. Impossible. Impossible to keep my eyes open. Alex?
Yeah?
Tell me that poem again. My voice doesn't sound like my own. My words seem to come from a distance.
Which one?
Alex whispers. The one you know by heart. Drifting. I'm drifting. I know a lot of them by heart. Anyone, then?
He takes a deep breath and begins.
I carry your heart with me. I carry it in my heart. I am never without it.
He speaks on, words washing over me, the way that sunlight skips over the surface of water and filters into the depths below, lighting up the darkness. I keep my eyes closed. Amazingly, I can still see the stars, whole galaxies blooming from nothing, pink and purple suns, vast silver oceans, a thousand white moons. It seems like I've only been asleep 5 minutes when Alex is gently shaking me awake. The sky is still inky black, the moon high and bright, but I can tell by the way the candles are pooling around us that I must have been out for at least an hour or so.
Time to go, he says,
brushing the hair off my forehead.
What time is it?
My voice is thick with sleep.
A little before 3?
Alex sits up and scoots off the bed, then reaches out a hand and pulls me to my feet.
We've got to cross before Sleeping Beauty wakes up. Sleeping Beauty?
I shake my head confusedly. Alex laughs softly.
After poetry,
he says, leaning down to kiss me,
we move on to fairy tales.
Then it's back through the woods, down the broken path that leads past the bombed-out houses, through the woods again. The whole time I feel as though I haven't quite woken up. I'm not even scared or nervous when we climb the fence. Getting over the barbed wire is infinitely easier the second time around, and I feel as though the shadows have texture and shield us like a cloak. The guard at hut number 21 is still in the exact same position, head tilted back, feet on his desk, mouth open, and soon we're weaving our way around the cove. Then we're slipping silently through the streets toward Deering Highlands. And it's then I have the strangest thought, half dread and half wish, that maybe all of this is a dream, and when I wake up, I will find myself in the wilds. Maybe I'll wake up and find I've always been there, and that all of Portland and the labs and the curfew and the procedure was some long, twisted nightmare. 37 Brooks. In through the window, and the heat and the smell of mildew slams us a wall. I only spent a few hours there, and I miss the wilds already. The wind through the trees that sounds just like the ocean, the incredible smells of blooming plants, the invisible scurrying things, all that life pushing and extending in every direction, on and on and on, no walls. Then Alex is leading me to the sofa and shaking out a blanket over me, kissing me and wishing me good night. He has the morning shift at the labs and has just barely enough time to go home, shower, and make it to work on time. I hear his footsteps melting away into the darkness. Then I sleep.
Love.
A single word. A wispy thing. A word no bigger or longer than an edge. That's what it is. An edge. A razor. It draws up through the center of your life, cutting everything in two, before and after. The rest of the world falls away on either side. Before and after, and during. A moment no bigger or longer than an edge. Chapter 19. Live free or die. Ancient saying, provenance unknown. Listed in the Comprehensive Compilation of Dangerous Words and Ideas, www.ccdwi.gov.org. One of the strangest things about life is that it will chug on, blind and oblivious, even as your private world, your little carved-out sphere, is twisting and morphing, even breaking apart. One day you have parents, the next day you're an orphan. One day you have a place and a path, the next day you're lost in a wilderness. And still the sun rises and clouds mass and drift and people shop for groceries and toilets flush and blinds go up and down. That's when you realize that most of it, life, the relentless mechanism of existing,
isn't about you. It doesn't include you at all. It will thrust onward even after you've jumped the edge. Even after you're dead. When I make my way back into downtown Portland in the morning, that's what surprises me the most. How normal everything looks. I don't know what I was expecting. I didn't really think that buildings would have tumbled down overnight, that the streets would have melted into rubble, but it's still a shock to see a stream of people carrying briefcases and shop owners unlocking their front doors and a single car trying to push through a crowded street. It seems absurd that they don't know, haven't felt any change or tremor, even as my life has been completely turned upside down. As I head home, I keep feeling paranoid, like someone will be able to smell the wilds on me, will be able to tell just from seeing my face that I've crossed over. The back of my neck itches as though it's being poked with branches, and I keep whipping off my backpack to make sure there aren't any leaves or burrs clinging to it. Not that it matters, since it's not like Portland is treeless. But no one even glances in my direction. It's a little before 9 o'clock, and most people are rushing to get to work on time. An endless blur of normal people doing normal things, eyes straight ahead of them, paying no attention to the short, nondescript girl with a lumpy backpack pushing past them. The short, nondescript girl with a secret burning inside of her, like a fire. It's as though my night in the wilds has sharpened my vision around the edges. Even though everything looks superficially the same, it seems somehow different. Flimsy, almost, as though you could put your hand through the buildings and sky and even the people. I remember being very young and watching Rachel build a sandcastle at the beach. She must have worked on it for hours, using different cups and containers to shape towers and turrets. When it was done, it looked perfect, like it could have been made out of stone. But when the tide came in, it didn't take more than 2 or 3 waves to dissolve its shape entirely. I remember I burst into tears and my mother bought me an ice cream cone and made me share it with Rachel. That's what Portland looks like this morning, like something in danger of dissolving. I keep thinking about what Alex always says. There are more of us than you think. I sneak a glance at everyone who goes by, thinking maybe I'll be able to read some secret sign on their faces, some mark of resistance. But everyone looks the same as always, harried, hurried, annoyed, zoned out. When I get home, Carol's in the kitchen washing dishes. I try to scoot past her, but she calls out to me. I pause with 1 foot on the stairs. She comes into the hallway, wiping her hands on a dish towel. "How was Hannah's?" she asks. She flicks her eyes all over my face, searchingly, as though checking for signs of something. I try to will back another bout of paranoia. She couldn't possibly know where I've been. "It was fine," I say, shrugging, trying to sound casual. "Didn't get a lot of sleep, though." Carol keeps looking at me intensely. "What did you girls do together?" She never asks about Hannah's house and hasn't for years. Something's wrong, I think. "You know, the usual. Watch some TV. Hannah gets like 7 channels. I can't tell if my voice sounds weird and high-pitched or if I'm just imagining it. Carol looks away, twisting her mouth up like she's accidentally gotten a mouthful of sour milk. I can tell she's trying to work out a way to say something unpleasant. She gets her sour milk face whenever she has to give out bad news. She knows about Alex. She knows. She knows. The walls press closer and the heat is stifling. Then, to my surprise, she curls her mouth into a smile, reaches out, and places a hand on my arm. "You know, Lena, it won't be like this for very much longer." I've successfully avoided thinking about the procedure for 24 hours, but now that awful, looming number pops back into my head, throwing a shadow over everything. 17 days. "I know," I squeeze out. Now my voice definitely sounds weird. Carol nods and keeps the strange half-smile plastered to her face. "I know it's hard to believe, but you won't miss her once it's over." "I know," like there's a dying frog caught in my throat. Carol keeps nodding at me really vigorously. It looks as though her head is connected to a yo-yo.
I get the feeling she wants to say something more, something that will reassure me, but she obviously can't think of anything because we just stand there, frozen like that, for almost a minute. Finally, I say, I'm going upstairs. Shower. It takes all my willpower just to get out the words. 17 days keeps tearing through my mind like an alarm. Carol seems relieved that I've broken the silence. Okay, she says. Okay. I start up the stairs 2 at a time. I can't wait to lock myself in the bathroom. Even though it must be more than 80 degrees in the house, I want to stand under a stream of beating hot water, melt myself into vapor. Oh, Lena! Carol calls out to me almost as an afterthought. I turn around and she's not looking at me. She's inspecting the fraying border of one of her dish towels. You should put on something nice. A dress, or those pretty white slacks you got last year, and do your hair. Don't just leave it to air dry. Why? I don't like the way she won't look at me, especially since her mouth is going all screwy again. I invited Brian Scharf to come over today, she says casually, as though it's an everyday normal thing. Brian Scharf? I repeat dumbly. The name feels strange in my mouth and brings with it the taste of metal. Carol snaps her head up and looks at me. Not alone, she says quickly. Of course, not alone. His mother will be coming with him, and I'll be here too, obviously. Besides, Brian had his procedure last month. As though that's what's bothering me. He's coming here? Today? I have to reach out and place one hand on the wall. Somehow I've managed to completely forget about Brian Scharf, that neat printed name on a page. Carol must think I'm nervous about meeting him because she smiles at me. Don't worry, Lena, you'll be fine. We'll do most of the talking. I just thought you two should meet, since... She doesn't finish her sentence. She doesn't have to. Since we're paired. Since we'll be married. Since I'll share my bed with him and wake up every day of my life next to him and have to let him put his hands on me and have to sit across from him at dinner eating canned asparagus and listening to him rattle on about plumbing or carpentry or whatever it is he's going to get assigned to do. No! I burst out. Carol looks startled. She's not used to hearing that word, certainly not from me. What do you mean, no? I lick my lips. I know refusing her is dangerous, and I know that it's wrong, but I can't meet Brian Scharf. I won't. I won't sit there and pretend to like him or listen to Carol talk about where we'll live in a few years while Alex is out there somewhere waiting for me to meet up with him or tapping his fingers against his desk while he listens to music or breathing or doing anything at all. I mean, I struggle for an excuse. I mean, couldn't we do it some other time? I don't really feel good. This, at least, is true. Carol frowns at me. It's an hour, Lena. If you can manage to sleep over at Hannah's house, you can manage that. But... I ball one fist up, squeezing my fingernails into my palm until pain starts blooming there, which gives me something to focus on. But I want it to be a surprise. Carol's voice takes on an edge. There's nothing surprising about this, Lena. This is the order of things. This is your life. He is your pair. You will meet him, and you will like him, and that's that. Now go upstairs and get in the shower. They'll be coming at 1 o'clock.
1. Alex gets off work at noon today. I was supposed to meet him. We were going to have a picnic at 37 Brooks, like we always do whenever he comes off the morning shift, and enjoy the whole afternoon together. But I start to protest, not even sure what else I can say.
No buts!
Carol crosses her arms and glares at me fiercely.
Upstairs.
I don't know how I make it up the stairs. I'm so angry I can barely see. Jenny's standing on the landing, chewing gum, dressed in one of Rachel's old bathing suits. It's too big for her.
What's wrong with you?
She says as I push past her. I don't answer. I make a beeline for the bathroom and turn the water on as high as it can go. Carol hates it when we waste water, and normally I make my showers as quick as I can, but today I don't care. I sit on the toilet and stuff my fingers in my mouth, biting down to keep from screaming. This is all my fault. I've been ignoring the date of the procedure, and I've avoided even thinking Brian Scharf's name. And Carol is absolutely right. This is my life, and the order of things. There's no changing it. I take a deep breath and tell myself to stop being such a baby. Everyone has to grow up sometime. My time is on September 3rd. I go to stand up, but an image of Alex last night, standing so close to me, speaking those weird, wonderful words. I love thee to the depth and breadth and height my soul can reach. Knocks me down again, and I thud back onto the toilet. Alex laughing, breathing, living, separately, unknown to me. Waves of nausea overtake me, and I double over with my head between my knees, fighting it. The disease. I tell myself the disease is progressing. It will all be better after the procedure. That's the point. But it's no use. When I finally manage to get into the shower, I try to lose myself in the rhythm of the water pounding on the porcelain, but images of Alex flicker through my mind, kissing me, stroking my hair, dancing his fingers over my skin, dancing, flashing like light from a candle about to be snuffed out. The worst is that I can't even let Alex know I won't be able to meet him. It's too dangerous to call him. My plan was to go to the labs and tell him in person, but when I come downstairs, showered and dressed and head for the door, Carol stops me. "Where do you think you're going?" she says sharply. I can tell she's still angry that I was arguing with her earlier. Angry and probably offended. She no doubt thinks I should be turning cartwheels because I've finally been paired. She has a right to think it. A few months ago, I would have been turning cartwheels. I turn my eyes to the ground, attempting to sound as sweet and meek as possible. I just thought I'd take a walk before Brian comes. I try to conjure up a blush. I'm kind of nervous.
You've been spending enough time out of the house as it is, Carol snaps back. And you'll only get sweaty and dirty again. If you want something to do, you can help me organize the linen closet.
There's no way I can disobey my aunt. So I follow her back upstairs and sit on the floor as she passes ratty towel after ratty towel down to me, and I inspect them for holes and stains and damage, fold and refold, count napkins. I am so angry and frustrated, I'm shaking. Alex won't know what has happened to me. He'll worry. Or even worse, he'll think I'm deliberately avoiding him. Maybe he'll think going to the wilds freaked me out. It frightens me. How violent I'm feeling, crazy almost, and capable of anything. I want to climb up the walls, burn down the house, something. Several times I have the fantasy of taking one of Carol's stupid dish towels and strangling her with it. This is what all the textbooks and the Book of Shh and parents and teachers have always warned me about. I don't know whether they're right or whether Alex is. I don't know whether these feelings, this thing growing inside of me, is something horrible and sick, or the best thing that's ever happened to me. Either way, I can't stop it. I've lost control, and the truly sick thing is that despite everything, I'm glad. At 12:30, Carol moves me downstairs to the living room, which I can tell has been straightened and cleaned. My uncle's shipping orders, which are usually scattered everywhere, have been stacked in a neat pile, and none of the old school books and broken toys that usually litter the floor are visible. She plops me down on a sofa and begins messing with my hair. I feel like a prize pig, but I know better than to say anything about it. If I do everything she tells me, if everything goes smoothly, maybe I'll still have time to go to 37 Brooks once Brian leaves.
"There," Carol says, stepping away and squinting at me critically. "That's as good as it's gonna get."
I bite my lip and turn away. I don't want her to notice, but her words have sent a sharp pain through me. Amazingly, I'd actually forgotten that I'm supposed to be plain. I'm so used to Alex telling me I'm beautiful. I'm so used to feeling beautiful around him. A hollow opens up in my chest. This is what life will be like without him. Everything will become ordinary again. I'll become ordinary again. At a few minutes after one, I hear the front gate squeak open and footsteps on the path. I've been so focused on Alex, I haven't had time to get nervous about Brian Scharf's arrival. But now I have the wild urge to make a run for the back door or hurtle through the open window. Thinking about what Carol would do if I went belly flopping through the screen brings on an uncontrollable fit of giggling. "Lena!" she hisses at me just as Brian and his mother start knocking on the front door. "Control yourself!" "Why?" I'm tempted to fire back.
It's not like he can do anything about it, even if he hates me. He's stuck with me, and I'm stuck with him. We're stuck. That's what growing up is all about, I guess. In my imagination, Brian Scharf was tall and fat, a hulking figure. In reality, he's only a few inches taller than I am, which is impressively short for a guy, and so thin I'm worried about breaking his wrist bone when we shake. His palms are damp with sweat, and he barely squeezes my hand. It feels like holding on to a damp tissue. Afterward, when we all take our seats, I surreptitiously wipe my hands against my pants. "Thank you for coming," Carol says, and there's a long, awkward pause. In the silence, I can hear Brian wheezing through his nose. It sounds like there's a dying animal trapped in his nasal canal. I must be staring because Mrs. Scharf explains, "Brian has asthma."
"Oh," I say.
"The allergies make it worse."
What is he allergic to?"
I ask because she seems to be expecting it.
"Dust," she says emphatically, like she's been waiting to break out that word since she sailed through the door.
She looks witheringly around the room, which is not dusty, and Carol blushes.
"And pollen, cats and dogs, of course, and peanuts, seafood, wheat, dairy, and garlic."
"I didn't know you could be allergic to garlic," I say. "I can't help it, it just pops out."
"His face puffs up like an accordion."
Mrs. Scharf turns a disdainful eye toward me as though I'm somehow responsible for this fact.
"Oh," I say again, and then another uncomfortable silence descends on us.
Brian doesn't say anything, but he wheezes louder than ever. This time Carol comes to the rescue.
"Lena," she says, "perhaps Brian and Mrs. Scharf would like some water."
I've never been so grateful for an excuse to leave a room in my life. I jump out of my seat, nearly taking down a lamp with my knee by accident.
"Of course, I'll get it."
"Make sure it's filtered,"
Mrs. Scharf calls after me as I tear out of the room.
"And not too much ice."
In the kitchen, I take my time filling up the glasses from the tap, obviously, and letting the cold air from the freezer blast my face. From the living room, I can hear the low murmur of conversation, but I can't make out who is speaking or what is being said. Maybe Mrs. Scharf decided to reprise her list of Brian's allergies. I know I have to go back into the living room eventually, but my feet just won't move toward the hallway. When I finally force them into action, they feel like they've been transformed into lead. Still, they carry me far too quickly toward the living room. I keep seeing an endless series of bland days. Days the color of pale yellow and white pills. Days that have the same bitter aftertaste as medicine. Mornings and evenings filled with a quietly whirring humidifier. With Brian's steady, wheezing breath. With the drip, drip, drip from a leaking faucet. There's no stopping it. The hallway doesn't last forever. And I step into the living room just in time to hear Brian say,
"She's not as pretty as in the pictures."
Brian and his mom have their backs to me, but Carol's mouth falls open when she sees me standing there, and both of the Scharfs whip around to face me. At least they have the grace to look embarrassed. He drops his eyes quickly and she flushes. I've never felt so ashamed or exposed. This is worse, even, than standing in the translucent hospital gown at the evaluations under the glare of the fluorescent lights. My hands are trembling so badly the water jumps over the lip of the glasses. "Here's your water." I don't know where I find the strength to come around the sofa and place the glasses down on the coffee table. "Not too much ice?"
"Lena,"
my aunt starts to say something, but I interrupt her.
"I'm sorry."
Miraculously, I even manage a smile. I can only hold it for a fraction of a second, though. My jaw is trembling, too, and I know that at any moment I might cry.
"I'm not feeling very well. I think I might step outside for a bit."
I don't wait to be given permission. I turn around and rush the front door. As I push out into the sun, I hear Carol apologizing for me.
"The procedure is still several weeks away,"
she's saying,
"so you'll have to forgive her for being so sensitive. I'm sure it will all work out."
The tears come hot and fast as soon as I'm outside.
The world begins to melt, colors and shapes bleeding together. The day is perfectly still. The sun has just inched past the middle of the sky, a flat, white disk, like a circle of heated metal. A red balloon is caught in a tree. It must have been there for a while. It is going limp, bobbing listlessly, half deflated at the end of its string. I don't know how I'll face Brian when I have to go back inside. I don't know how I'll face him ever. 1,000 awful things race through my mind, insults I'd like to hurl at him. At least I don't look like a tapeworm, or has it ever occurred to you that you're allergic to life? But I know I won't, can't say any of those things. Besides, the problem isn't really that he wheezes or is allergic to everything. The problem isn't even that he doesn't think I'm pretty. The problem is that he isn't Alex. Behind me, the door squeaks open. Brian says,
Lena?
I mash my palms against my cheeks quickly, wiping away the tears. The absolute last thing in the world I want is for Brian to know that his stupid comment has upset me. I'm fine, I call back without turning, since I'm sure I look like a mess. I'll come inside in a second. He must be stupid or stubborn because he doesn't leave me alone. Instead, he closes the door behind him and comes down off the front stoop. I hear him wheezing a few feet behind me.
Your mom said it was okay if I came out with you, he says.
She's not my mom, I correct him quickly. I don't know why it seems so important to say. I used to like it when people confused Carol for my mom. It meant they didn't know the real story. Then again, I used to like a lot of things that seem ridiculous now.
Oh, right.
Brian must know something about my real mom. It's on the record he would have seen.
Sorry, I forgot.
Of course you did, I think, but don't say anything. At least the fact that he's hovering over me has made me too angry to be sad anymore. The tears have stopped. I cross my arms and wait for him to take the hint, or get tired of staring at my back, and go inside. But the steady wheezing continues. I've known him less than half an hour, and already I could kill him. Finally, I get tired of standing there in silence, so I turn around and brush past him quickly. Feeling much better now, I say. I don't look at him as I start toward the house. We should go in.
Wait, Lena.
He reaches out and grabs my wrist. I guess grabs isn't really the right word, more like wipes sweat on. But I stop anyway, though I still can't bring myself to meet his eyes. Instead, I keep my eyes locked on the front door, noticing for the first time that the screen has 3 large holes in it near the upper right corner. No wonder the house has been full of insects this summer. Grace found a ladybug in our bedroom the other day. She brought it to me cupped in her tiny palm. I helped her carry it downstairs and release it outside. I feel an overwhelming rush of sadness, unrelated to Alex or Brian or any of that. I'm just struck with a sense of time passing so quickly, rushing forward. One day I'll wake up and my whole life will be behind me, and it will seem to have gone as quickly as a dream.
I didn't mean for you to hear what I said before, he says.
I wonder if his mom made him say this. The words seemed to require a tremendous effort on his part.
It was rude.
As if I haven't already been completely humiliated, now he has to apologize for calling me ugly. My cheeks feel like they're going to melt off, they're so hot. Don't worry about it, I say, trying to extricate my wrist from his hand. Surprisingly, he won't let me go, even though technically he shouldn't be touching me at all.
What I meant was...
His mouth works up and down for a second. He won't meet my eyes. He keeps scanning the street behind me, his eyes darting back and forth like a cat watching a bird.
What I meant was... You looked happier in the pictures.
This is a surprise, and for a second I can't think of a response. I don't seem happy now? I splutter out, and then feel even more embarrassed. It's so weird to be having this conversation with a stranger, knowing he won't be a stranger for very much longer. But he doesn't seem freaked out by the question. He just shakes his head.
I know you aren't, he says.
He drops my wrist, but I don't feel as desperate to go inside anymore. He's still staring off at the street behind me, and I sneak a closer look at his face. I guess he could be kind of good-looking. Not nearly so gorgeous as Alex, obviously. He's super pale and slightly feminine-looking, with a full, round mouth and a small, tapered nose. But his eyes are a clear, pale blue, like a morning sky, and he has a nice, strong jawline. And now I start to feel guilty. He must know I'm unhappy because I've been paired with him. It's not his fault I've changed, seen the light, or contracted the deliria, depending on who you ask. Maybe both. I'm sorry, I say. It's not you. I'm just scared about the procedure, that's all. I think of how many nights I used to fantasize about stretching out on the operating table, waiting for the anesthesia to turn the world to fog, waiting to wake up, renewed. Now I'll be waking up to a world without Alex. I'll be waking up into the fog, everything gray and blurry and unrecognizable. Brian is looking at me, finally, with an expression I can't identify at first. Then I realize, pity. He feels sorry for me. He starts speaking all in a rush. Listen, I probably shouldn't tell you this, but before my procedure, I was like you. His eyes click back to the street. The wheezing has stopped. He speaks clearly but low, so Carol and his mom can't hear through the open window. I wasn't ready. He licks his lips, drops his voice to a whisper. There was a girl I used to see sometimes at the park. She babysat for her cousins, used to bring them to the playground there. I was captain of the fencing team in high school. It's where we practiced. He would be captain of the friggin' fencing team, I think, but I don't say this out loud. I can tell he's trying to be nice. Anyway, we used to talk sometimes. Nothing happened. He qualifies quickly. Just a few conversations here and there. She had a pretty smile, and I felt... He trails off. Wonder and fear sweep through me. He's trying to tell me that we're alike. He somehow knows about Alex, not about Alex specifically, but about someone. Wait a second. My mind is churning. Are you trying to say that before the procedure you got sick? I'm just saying I understand. His eyes flick to mine for barely a fraction of a second, but that's all I need. I'm positive now. He knows I've been infected. I'm both relieved and terrified. If he can see it, other people will see it too.
My point is only that the cure works.
He places extra emphasis on the last word. I know now that he's trying to be kind.
I'm much happier now. You will be too, I promise.
Something inside of me fractures when he says that, and I feel like I could cry again. His voice is so reassuring. There's nothing I want more in that moment than to believe him. Safety, happiness, stability, what I've wanted my whole life. And for that moment, I think maybe the past few weeks really have just been some long, strange delirium. Maybe after the procedure I'll wake up as from a high fever with only a vague recollection of my dreams and a sense of overwhelming relief.
Friends, Brian says, offering me his hand to shake.
And this time I don't flinch when he touches me. I even let him hold my hand an extra few seconds. He's still facing the street, and as we're standing there, a frown flickers temporarily across his face.
What does he want?
He mutters, and then calls out,
It's okay, she's my pair.
I turn around just in time to see a flash of burnt golden brown hair, the color of leaves in autumn, disappear around the corner. Alex. I wrench my hand away from Brian's, but it's too late. He's gone.
Must have been a regulator, Brian says. He was just standing there, staring.
The feeling of calm and reassurance I'd had only a minute earlier vanishes in a rush. Alex saw me. He saw us, holding hands, heard Brian say I was his pair, and I was supposed to have met him an hour ago. He doesn't know that I couldn't get out of the house, couldn't get a message to him. I can't imagine what he must be thinking about me right now. Or actually, I can imagine.
Are you okay?
Brian's eyes are so pale they're almost gray. A sickly color, not like sky at all, like mold or rot.
I can't believe I thought he could be attractive for even a second.
You don't look too good.
I'm fine. I try to take a step toward the house and stumble. Brian reaches out to steady me, but I twist away from him. I'm fine, I repeat, even though everything around me is breaking, fracturing.
It's hot out here,
he says. I can't stand to look at him.
Let's go inside.
He puts a hand on my elbow and propels me up the stairs, through the door, and into the living room, where Carol and Mrs. Scharf are waiting for us, smiling. Chapter 20. Ex Remedium Salus. From the Cure, Salvation. Printed on all American currency. By some miracle, I must make a good enough impression on Brian and Mrs. Scharf to satisfy Carol, even though I barely speak during the remainder of their visit. Or maybe because I barely speak. It's mid-afternoon by the time they leave, and although Carol insists I help out with a few more chores and she makes me stick around for dinner, every minute that I can't run to Alex in agony, 60 seconds of pure driving torture, she promises me I can go for a walk when I'm done eating, before curfew. I inhale my baked beans and frozen fish sticks so fast I almost puke, and practically sit bouncing in my chair until she releases me. She even lets me out of dishwashing duty, but I'm too angry at her for cooping me up in the first place to feel grateful. I go to 37 Brooks first. I don't really think he'll be there waiting for me, but I'm hoping for it anyway. But the rooms are empty. The garden, too. I must be half delirious by that point because I check behind the trees and bushes as though he might suddenly pop out, like he used to do a few weeks ago when he and Hannah and I would play our epic games of hide-and-seek. Just thinking about it brings a sharp pain to my chest. Less than a month ago, all of August still stretched before us, long and golden and reassuring, like an endless period of delicious sleep. Well, now I've woken up. I make my way back through the house, seeing all our stuff scattered in the living room, blankets, a few magazines and books, a box of crackers and some cans of soda. Old board games, including a half-completed game of Scrabble, abandoned when Alex began making up words like quaz and yreg, makes me overwhelmingly sad and reminds me of that single house that survived the Blitz, and that cracked and bombed-out street, a place where everybody went on stupidly doing everyday things, right up until the moment of disaster, and afterward everyone said, how could they not have known what was coming? Stupid. Stupid to be so careless with our time, to believe we had so much of it left. I head into the streets, frantic and desperate now, but unsure of what to do next. He mentioned to me once that he lived on Forsyth, a long row of gray slab buildings owned by the university, so I go that way. But all the buildings look identical. There must be dozens of them, hundreds of individual apartments. I'm tempted to tear through each and every one until I find him, but that would be suicide. After a couple of students give me suspicious glances, I'm sure I look like a disaster, red-faced and wild-eyed and close to hysterical. I duck into a side street. To calm myself, I start reciting the elemental prayers. H is for hydrogen, a weight of one, when fissions split, as brightly lit, as hot as any sun. I'm so distracted walking home that I get lost in the tangle of streets leading away from the UP campus. I end up on a narrow one-way street I've never seen before and have to backtrack to Monument Square. The governor is standing there as always, his empty palm outstretched, looking sad and forlorn in the fading evening light, as though he's a beggar, forever condemned to ask for alms. But seeing him,